then for two-dimensional black holes to see how the results compare with what at least I would expect to happen from a four-dimensional and higher-dimensional black holes. And for those of you who didn't hear the previous, I'm just advertising a little bit of Alberta here. This is a scene from the top of Mount Temple, which is, some people say it's the highest mountain you can climb by just scrambling without having any technical skills in the Rockies. So it's, and there's Moraine Lake, and my car was right down there, and there, this is the Valley of the Ten Peaks, which used to be on the, I think it was a $20 bill sometimes back. Okay, so Eugenio Bianchi and Matteo Smrlik have found a relationship between the Hawking radiation energy and the von Neumann entropy in a conformal field emitted by a semi-classical two-dimensional black hole, or in other words, a definite metric, or just a moving mirror, definite boundary conditions. So then my postdoc, Shori Abdulrahimi, and I have then compared this relation to what might be expected for unitary evolution for a quantum black hole in four and higher dimensions. So if one neglects the expected increase in the radiation entropy over the decrease in the black hole, Bekenstein-Hawking quarter A entropy that arises from the scattering of radiation by the barrier near the black hole, the relation works very well, except near the peak in the radiation von Neumann entry and near the final evaporation. So these discrepancies are calculated, discussed as tiny differences between a semi-classical treatment and what at least I might expect to come from a quantum gravity treatment. So, okay, so Bianchi and Smrlik have found a beautiful formula relating the Hawking radiation energy flux F. And here, by the way, I'll use F as really a luminosity or power. So it's not, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, of course, there's no transverse area. So it's equivalent to that per area. But when I use it later, it will be energy per time, or power or luminosity. And the retarded time derivatives, that is on Scribe Plus, where you measure the von Neumann entanglement entropy S at future null infinity for a two-dimensional conformal field in a fixed two-dimensional classical or semi-classical space-time. So it's basically fluxes. There is a first derivative squared term and a second derivative term. So wait a minute. Somebody, maybe it was Valerie Fulla, somebody pointed out when I gave this talk that this looks somewhat similar to the radiation from a charged particle. If this is the acceleration squared and then the derivative of acceleration. So I don't know if there's any relationship there. But anyway, interesting just mathematical similarity between the formula for emission from a charged particle. But probably that's just an accident. OK, so F is the energy flux, or energy per time at future null infinity.
C is the central charge,
right. So OK, it's a function of retarded time U. S is the renormalized entanglement entropy of radiation at scribe up to the time U. So going from minus infinity up to time U, and then you're basically subtracting off what you'd get if there was the vacuum. So the S doesn't have to be positive. the C is the constant, central charge, but I apply it to four dimensions. I'll just allow it to be any constant. And then these dots represent derivatives with respect to the time. So this formula has been applied to many solvable models of quantum of gravitational collapse by Bianchi, DiLorenzo, and Smrlik. So here I wish to compare this with this formula with what is expected, or at least what I would expect to be the case for the energy flux and von Neumann entropy of Hawking radiation of massless fields from a four-dimensional spherically symmetrical black hole. So for the emission of a conformally invariant scalar field, one might expect the Hawking radiation to be dominated by the scalar field modes that have zero angular momentum, or in other words, S waves, and hence are spherically symmetrical. So effectively reducing the problem to a two-dimensional one, for which you might expect the formula of Bianchi and Smrlik to apply at least at some level of approximation. So let's see, how this works. Okay, so points of agreement, we do find that there, during most of the Hawking emission by a black hole, of initial mass m naught that's large in Planck units, this first term in the formula, the s dot squared term, on the right side dominates over the second term, over the second derivative. So then the power law dependence of this first term The dependence of this on the mass is the same power law is that of the flux on the left side. So by choosing the constant C appropriately, you can get a good match between the left and right sides when this term dominates. But there are some differences. So for example, let's suppose SBH represents the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole, which is the area over 4G. So this is not the von Neumann entropy. It represents the logarithm of the dimension of the black hole Hilbert space, but it doesn't say whether or not the hole is, if it's a pure state, the von Neumann entropy would be zero. But I'm taking this to be an approximate upper bound to the von Neumann entropy of the black hole. Then the logarithm of what you might interpret as the effective dimension of the radiation Hilbert space is just the thermodynamic entropy of that. And that's equal to the decrease in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole, but augmented by a factor B, which comes from the scattering by the potential outside the horizon. I mean, in other words, it's the emission is not adiabatic because you're emitting from a black hole of positive temperature in the empty space of zero temperature. So there's extra entropy, extra thermodynamic entropy generated by this emission process. So based on calculations I did in the 70s for my PhD, in four dimensions, the emission of the massless particles, photons and gravitons, give this about this. I'm not confident of all the digits, but I put them in there in case anybody wants to repeat the calculation and see how many I got right. Hopefully I got at least two right, but I don't know. So the von Neumann entropy is believed to be approximately the smaller of these two. It's bounded. It would be bounded by the maximum entropy for the radiation and by the maximum entropy of the black hole. And there are arguments that I've made before that suggest that the actual von Neumann entropy should be nearer to the maximum it could be, which is bounded by one or the other of these two. Well, basically the argument was that if you have a total system that's composed of two subsystems, then okay, if the whole system is in a pure state, then the von Neumann entropy of the whole thing, of course, is zero. But if you trace over this one part, you get a von Neumann entropy of this, and that's the same as the von Neumann entropy of this that you get by tracing over that when it's a pure state. So then what I calculated was, the von Neumann entropy, of course, depends on the pure state. If the pure state's a product state, you'll get zero von Neumann entropy for the subsystem. If it's not a pure state, you won't. So what I did was calculate the average of the entropy, averaging doing the Haar measure over the pure states of the combined system. And I found that this average is very close to the log of the number of states of the smaller system. I mean, it can't be bigger than the log of the smaller system. But it turns out it's very close. And even when you divide it up into two subsystems that have the same dimension, each have the same dimension, the deviation is only about a half unit of entropy. So it goes very close to the, you know, if one system, if you imagine moving the barrier between the two sides. And so then one system, as you move the barrier, the max, the log in goes up this way, and if the other one goes down, it's just very close to this. It stays very close to that thing. So here I'm assuming that this applies. Of course, this is a bit different because the radiation, of course, is really an empty space, so it's an infinite dimensional thing. But I'm saying let's take the effective dimension to be given by the thermodynamic entropy of the radiation. And then I'm, you know, assuming without proof that essentially this would carry over, it would be close to the maximum of either this or this, depending on which is bigger. So, okay, so the von Neumann entropy is approximately smaller of these. So during the first stage, then of course the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is going down because the area is going down. Wait a minute. Yeah, so this is negative, and then another might makes this positive. So the von Neumann entropy first goes up for the radiation, and then in the second stage it goes down. But the relation between the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, it's different. In the first stage there's a factor of B here, and in the second stage there's not. So therefore, the ratio, taking the square, of course, gets rid of the sign. The fraction between this drops by a factor of 1 over b squared from the first stage to the second stage. So this would require, if you wanted to match both halves, you'd have to change the c. This is the von Neumann entropy. And which is also equal to that of the Hawking radii. I'm assuming that I formed the black hole in the pure state. So I have a pure state. So this S is the von Neumann entropy of the radiation.
Okay, so it's the same as
what, sorry?
As S radiation.
Well, it's not. In the early stages, then the radiation is basically uncorrelated between the different modes. So in the early stage, the von Neumann entropy of the radiation is the thermodynamic entropy. But I'm saying when the black hole totally, at the later stages, now there's entanglement between these all, between huge collections of modes. So the von Neumann entropy gets less than the thermodynamic entropy. In other words, this would be the entropy of the radiation if you divided the radiation up into the different modes, calculate the density matrix of each mode and calculate the entropy of that and add it up over all the modes. And I think in the early stage, there's going to be negligible correlations between the modes, so that the von Neumann entropy of the whole collection in the early stage will be close to the sum of the individual parts. At late stages, there will be entanglement, and so the von Neumann entropy will be less. And so that's why in the latter stages, it drops below this, because this thing gets bigger than this in the latter stage, but the von Neumann entropy can't be bigger than that. Okay, so I'm saying that this ratio, if you drop that second derivative term, then this should be a constant. But here it jumps. I mean, it's a pretty close to constant in the first part, and pretty close to constant in the second part, but it jumps. So that's maybe a difference from what you would get by, well, extrapolating their formula. I mean, there's no problem that I see. Well, I haven't derived their formula. They did that. But I'm not questioning anything about their formula in two dimensions. What I'm talking about here, of course, is the application, the four dimensions, and to see how well does it fit what we might expect to be happening. So it seems like there is an issue that this C would have to drop if you wanted this to fit. Okay, a second difference is that when the S U goes from increasing to decreasing at the turnaround point, there's a brief period during where it's this term, of course, is negative because it's bending down, but then this term goes to zero. So there's a brief period here in which F gets negative, that the expectation value of the energy as seen in scribe plus is negative. And so if you trusted this formula during this stage, it would seem the black hole would have to gain a bit of energy near the peak rather than continuously losing energy.
Isn't the first time much bigger than the second time?
It's much bigger during most of the time, but right at the turnover, I'm saying, of course, this has to go through, the S dot goes from being positive to being negative. So S dot at some point it goes to zero. And this, of course, is negative because it's bending over at that point. So there has to be, if the entropy goes up and down, then there has to be a point where this thing is negative. I mean, of course, if it was sharp, there'd be a delta function. But I mean, the second derivative would just have a delta function in it, and there'd just be a delta function negative flux in this. Okay, so in some sense, you know, we wouldn't really expect the black hole to be gaining energy. So that's, I mean, I don't know, at least maybe that's my interpretation, that I wouldn't expect the black hole really be. Yeah, so we're really evaluating this at future null infinity. So, of course, it could be. What, evaluated? Yeah. So, okay, then the third thing, if you extrapolate the semi-classical approximation for this at late times as a function of black hole mass down to the Planck and sub-Planck values, where it's not believed to be valid, so this is, you know, doing a naive, then you again get a regime where the second term dominates and you get a negative expression at the very end. But this, I can show you can sort of get rid of by just saying, well, let's suppose S has a slightly different form near the end. S dot basically goes as a constant over the radius of the black hole. So the derivative. Yeah, I mean the derivative goes as r. Let's say if r is the size of the whole, r dot over r squared, but then the second. Okay, I'll show you the expressions later. I mean, it's basically, I'm just basically saying, suppose you said if you use the formulas that apply for a big black hole and you just extrapolate them down to a small black hole, then the second derivative would dominate. But we'll see this later. I mean, I'm just summarizing it now. I'll go into the detail. Yeah, if it leveled off. I'm just saying that if you take the Hawking emission, because the rate gets faster the smaller the hole is, at the late stage, it's not just it bends down this way, is the point. So because it bends down, the second derivative diverges faster than the first derivative diverges. I mean, both derivatives diverge, but the second derivative diverges faster than the square of the first derivative at late stage, if you use the naive thing.
They are the ones that would contribute to that second term because those are Planck suppressed, basically.
Well, I think he's arguing that, take this, maybe you don't trust it when it's Planck scale, but you probably trust it roughly when it's 10 times the Planck scale.
The problem at the very end is not, I would not regard it all as a serious problem.
Those are all quantum gravity corrections that depend on all these higher order operators that are not known in quantum gravity. So I'm just wondering why should we take that second term seriously, because it just depends on unknown coupling constants of the quantum of the UV completion of gravity.
Okay, I mean, I may have to defer to Matteo as to whether there's arguments for taking it seriously in four dimensions. Basically what I'm doing is just trying to compare. You know, he has a formula that's derived to work in two dimensions. So then it's a question, how well does it work?
Normalizable in two dimensions, so that's the more meaningful thing to do. But so that would be the difference.
Yeah. So there might be, so exactly what are the reasons? I'm pointing out some problems with the thing in four dimensions, but I don't have a cure for the, well, I don't know what the right answer is. I'm just trying to compare, what this formula would give if you applied it, if you just took it over naively into four dimensions, with what I would expect to happen. And yes.
If you remove that transparency from your talk, would it make any difference to the rest of your talk?
The previous transparency?
Right.
So I remove that one.
Well,
though, except that I'll give some ad hoc cure to this problem. But it'll be ad hoc. But I'm saying that you could have it instead of keep bending down. It doesn't bend down so much. Anyway, okay. So this is just reviewing d-dimensional non-rotating spherical uncharged Schwarzschild Tangerlini black hole, and I'll use capital R for the horizon radius. So it's short for that. So then anyway, so it has a mass parameter, and then the actual mass is, some constants times this thing. And the Bekenstein-Hawking thermodynamic entropy is the area over 4G, which is this expression. And then, okay, the Hawking radiation entropy into massless particles, basically any dimension, the energy per time, because the energy per time basically just depends on the geometry. So you don't need to have a G into that, I mean, once you have the geometry. So with just H bar and C equal to 1, energy has units of 1 over time, and then 1 over, respect to time, it goes 1 over time squared. I'm setting C equal to 1. So it basically goes as 1 over the square of the radius in any dimension. And then there's some constant that, of course, is going to depend on the fields and what the dimension is. And so if I write it in terms of mass, I get this. In four dimensions, by PhD calculations, then the d equal 4 give this constant this. You can see It's a, oh, that's the, oh, sorry, that's the rate, that's the area of a unit d minus 2 sphere. D is the dimension of the space-time, so the dimension, the horizon is a, is a, of a unit sphere. It's the one you have their standard formula with gamma functions and so on.
For.
Yeah, you know, the thing that's that goes from 2 to 2 pi to 4 pi to 8 pi squared and so on and so on. The, Yeah. So this is 4 pi for d equals 4. Right. So, okay. So that's right. So then the, well, it's partly a geometric, let's see, if I remember right, is there chalk here? A geometric optics approximation basically gives, for photon gravity, gives 9 over, wait a minute, I can't remember whether it's the pi squared or, so, okay, there's one factor that just comes from two pi's and whatnot. If you just take the if you take the impact parameter, the critical impact parameter for a black hole, so it gives it effective cross section of 27 pi m squared. So if you do that and just put in the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, you would get this from geometrical optics thing. Then the numerical calculation, so it's smaller by a factor of 7.5 or so, and that's from the effects that Bill is saying that. Well, effectively, for photons, the cross-section goes as frequency squared at low frequency. And for gravitons, it goes as frequency to the fourth power. So there's suppression by these barriers, and that gives an additional factor. So that's why this thing, wait a minute, maybe that's, sorry, I say this is alpha, but that's over A. Let's see, so A is, sorry, there may be a factor of 4 here because I'm comparing something where I had the mask. Anyway, let's not worry about it. That may be off. That's something else. There's a 4 in there that goes in the numerator denominator. I forget which. Okay. So all right. So then, if you just have this evolve by this, then the lifetime of the hole basically goes as the initial size to the d minus 1 power. In other words, in four dimensional space time, it goes as the third power. And in terms of the mass, it goes as this. So again, in four dimensions, that's 3/1. That's the third power. And okay, so that's the lifetime. And then the mass just goes down by this function. And you see it gets steeper later on. And the radiation entropy, the thermodynamic radiation entropy goes up by this factor. And then eventually, of course, reaches this thing. So if you do the von Neumann entropy, then I'm saying that these two things should give approximate upper bounds in the von Neumann entropy, and these cross at this particular value, and so we'd expect, and if the theta function is, the Heaviside function, then we'd expect that the von Neumann entropy to have approximately this form, that it has a stage where it's going up, and then a stage where it's going down. So then, if we take the Hawking temperature, has this form, and then the mass flux basically gives the derivative of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy goes as a/r/1 and the second derivative, going back to the previous slide, and so it has stuffing, it goes as r to the d. So that then well, putting in the time dependence, there's the one part where it's increasing and another part where it's decreasing. Of course, r is a function of u also. And then the second derivative has this term. And then using this part, I have a sharp thing. So there's a negative delta function contribution there under the approximation that it's a sharp turnoff. I'll modify that a little bit later. But okay, so that's... So then, except for retarded times, there either you're this turnover time or the total time, then I said the first term dominates. And so for most of the times, other than this turnover point and also near the end, then the Bianchi-Smirnoff flux is given by this formula. And so as you can see, because this B squared comes in there, if you wanted to really, if you wanted to fit this thing, then the C would have to jump. So the C would have to take this value that jumps at this point. But, you know, C is supposed to be constant, not changing between these periods. So this is, you know, this is a discrepancy between applying the model, not with the original. I don't have any criticisms of the original derivation. It's just applying it, there seems to be this issue that you would, if you wanted to fit, you'd have to have the C changing from the first to the second part. Yeah, so it's. I'll later show if you put this smooth, a little bit more smooth turnover, which you could get by using these. But let me get to that. But okay, so now you could. So this here's a plot of the black hole mass versus time. The black curve is what I'd expect just by saying that the power goes as 1/1 the square of the size, and then I'm saying if you used what we expect for S, for the von Neumann entropy, and plugged it into the Bianchi-Smirnoff formula, if you use the value of C that matched in the first part, then you get this curve, but then in the second part, because that you go from B squared to not having B squared, it would go into this form. On the other hand, if you choose the constant C to fit the second part of the emission, then that's too low an emission it gives too low a value of F in the first part. And then the second part, as a function of R, it's right, but of course you've already lowered that, so you know at the end you get a negative value if you integrate that. So if you choose the right value of C, you could fit the first part, but then it doesn't fit the second part. This would fit the second part if I'd really said the mass was that value up there, but because I've calculated as if you know the mass was less there, then of course you get a lower value over here. Okay, now let's look at the peak. So I'm saying the peak is not going to be in S is not going to be absolutely sharp. So what I found in these papers in what was it, 73 or something, the average von Neumann entropy of a if you have two Hilbert spaces of dimensions, they're both much bigger than one. But let's suppose M is the smaller one. It could be equal, but if it's smaller, then the von Neumann entropy it's basically the logarithm of the smaller system. And then there's a small correction factor that's basically the dimension of the smaller one over twice the dimension of the larger one. So it's basically, you see, when m equals n, it's just a half unit. The thing curves over and it's like a half unit lower than what you would get if you just had it a sharp turnover. So, all right, now let's, so what I will do is now say that I'll take this logarithm as being I'll represent that by the thermodynamic entropy, and I'll imagine that it's continuous. Of course, you know, you might say, well, it's, but if I take that as a continuous, and then if I define this quantity here, which is going up because I mean this is the initial Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. This one is the actual Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. This is going down, but the minus sign means this goes up. Then I can if I put in this effect, so I round off the things, then I basically get the entropy having this form, and it turns out that these two sides, the value and the first and I think the second derivative, match on the two sides when I go from x equals negative to positive. So although there's theta functions here, the value and the first derivative and the second derivative all match at that point. Yes.
What's the fluctuation in S in that, you know, when you divide a typical system into half and you're calculating the average entropy here over the space, if I now ask what are the fluctuations, you know, S minus S bar squared.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't. I haven't calculated that. I'm not. Could I even give an estimate? I had, but I'm guessing the fluctuations are of order of the DVA. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing the fluctuations are comparable to this or something. But
it's a highly non-Gaussian distribution. I mean, the distribution of S has got these massive peaks. I mean, S goes to zero for all kinds of states. So it has these humongous peaks all over the place. So it's a very, very non-Gaussian distribution. So I'm just wondering if that's been calculated by anybody. But you're saying no.
Well, what I'm saying is that I haven't calculated it, and I'm not right now aware of whether somebody has calculated, but it could well be that somebody's calculated. I don't know. That's.
I mean, I think somebody can just do a probability distribution about that. I don't know if anybody has done it, but I think it should be an elementary calculation. That's just my feeling.
Yeah. Well. Effectively, it was. I think Lubkin and Pagels and Lloyd actually did the probability distribution for S, and I basically used their formulas and calculated the average. So the probability is the probability is very low that it's significantly different from this. So I think the probability is very there's only a very tiny fraction of states that actually have entropy that's significantly less than this. So I think that.
But the distribution can also only go in one direction. I mean, you can't have a huge fluctuation in the positive direction for S. You can't have an entropy bigger, much, much bigger than log n, for example.
Right, right. So I mean,
the distribution is a very one sided, highly non Gaussian distribution, and they can have weird properties.
Yeah, okay, I'm not sure. I think the tails just die off so fast that no matter what. Okay, this I'm kind of speculating about. I think they die off exponentially so fast that for any reasonable power of S, you wouldn't get a value much less than the power of this thing, I think. But yeah, because I'm pretty sure it dies off exponentially. Oh, yes. Right. Well, yeah. So I'm imagining that. I'm imagining that really I'm letting the radiation go to scry plus,
yeah.
And I'm looking at it up to there. I'm looking at all the radiation up to some time at scry plus, and I'm saying that that's a subsystem of the total rate because I'm not including what happened after that. So I'm assuming that I'm assuming unitarity. So I'm assuming if I looked at over the whole of scry plus. All the way to U equals infinity, then I get a pure state. But if I just look up to some point, then then it's a subsystem. Of course, you have to do some regularization.
What do you do actually? You actually compute an entanglement entropy?
Well,
it doesn't do that as well. So, I think this formula is
that's a very different
system.
Well, the expressions that I gave came from assuming that it's that in some sense it's a typical state, assuming that that in some sense the.
But operationally, what do you actually compute?
Well, what I compute is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy to give me the one of the dimensions, and I calculate the thermodynamic entropy of the radiation to give me the other dimension, and then I stick it into this formula. Yeah. So I get like the area of the horizon to get.
I thought that was HPA.
Yeah. So no. But I'm saying for this, then I plug it into this formula. I calculate, I say that M. Well, let's suppose it's the first half. It's the early part. So the smaller subsystem is the radiation. So what I do is instead of M, I take the exponential of the thermodynamic entropy of the radiation. So that I use for M. For N, I take the exponential of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Then I plug it into this formula. and get it. And of course, at the later times, it just reversed. I mean, reverse M and N in there. So that. Well, I get the thermodynamic entropy by basically the numerical calculations I did in the 70s for what's the expected number of particles in each mode. And it turns out each mode, according to the Hawking formula, comes out having a density matrix that's diagonal in the number representation, and it's geometric. So it's just like a thermal distribution. So you can easily calculate the entropy of each mode for each frequency. And then, of course, I numerically integrated this over all the modes to find out what's the thermodynamic entropy. In other words, what's the sum of the von Neumann entropies of all the modes that come out? So I did that in numerical calculation.
Of course, those modes that you looked at existed for an infinite amount of time, and you're actually trying to apply this over a finite length.
So at the beginning of the curve, you can either estimate in this way, or at least in some approximation, exactly as an entanglement entropy, you compute and you get the
That's it. Again,
entanglement entropy of a free scalar field.
No,
when inside and outside the horizon, is that what you're doing?
So there's a renormalized version of entanglement entropy, which you can compute exactly, and which grows exactly as expected from this thermodynamical computation. The point is, after the beginning then you stop guessing. You don't compute. And so what Don is saying here is, for the rest, what's going to happen is it's eventually going to become the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. And so it will force it to go down because the black hole is shrinking. So then that's the guess part. So there's really two parts. The beginning, you can compute in some way with some problem. You can discuss.
So in the beginning, you have to go back to the beginning. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Outside of here, so compute. So in the beginning,
you compute.
You compute what? Like an actual entanglement entropy?
Yeah, so I'm putting in guesses here. So, okay, so basically now, before when I gave the formula, I just had it, there was a sharp jump and I got a delta function. Now, because I'm putting in this factor, I get a smooth behavior. And so this flux is, go like this. And so now let me plot this. So I'm taking the flux and I'm multiplying by the inverse of what the naive expectation. And so that's this thing. Now, because I'm choosing, for this calculation, a constant value of C across the transition, and I chose the value to make it fit at the late times. So late means just after this transition. So this is, I'm plotting this versus the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy at this transition time, minus what it actually is. So this is happening over a period when the von Neumann or when the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is changing by just a few units. So that's basically the time involved for that is just the time to emit a few particles. So the time is of order the size of the black hole that this time period is happening. Okay. So now, as I say, I chose a constant C. I did not put C jumping from one value. I had a constant C, and I chose the constant value to fit at late times. So you can see, of course, it doesn't fit at early times. It's giving more flux than you would expect. But the thing is, I'm showing now that it dips down, and it does become negative. But you can see that it becomes negative for a very brief period. It's just a very tiny negative contribution here for a very brief period. So next, Shori and I integrated the negative part of this flux. So let's choose. Well, I'm using the S dot squared and the S double dot.
But
term.
But then the formula for S, that was just you just used the first correction to log, that was M over 2N. Did you
So basically I went back and I used this formula for the von Neumann entropy. What do you mean the rest of the, well, I'm using the, pro, this is, I mean, there is an exact formula. Well, I'm saying this is a very good approximation for the thing. It's not.
Up until the midpoint where M becomes the same as N, right? And this is an expansion in M over N.
So I'm saying this is the league. I mean, there's other, I guess there's other terms that are higher power. Well, wait a minute, but it does go to a half at this thing. So I mean, this is a good if M and N are both big, this is a very good approximation for the average entropy of the subsystem. When M is equal to N, if you swap it around, you get exactly the same expression because this M over N is just one. Yeah. So it matches, but then not only that, also that if you, of course, of course, this formula was derived when I had Hilbert spaces of discrete dimensions, so M and N had to be integers. Here, I'm interpolating and I'm imagining that instead of restricting it to be integers, I'll take them to be the exponential of the entropy. So I'm allowing it to be continuous. But I'm saying if you allow it to be continuous, this formula, I mean it matches at the when you cross over point in the first derivative, and I think the second derivative also matches. The third derivative, I think, is slightly different or something. So that's why I'm getting this smooth curve because of this thing. If I just had this piece, there would be this sudden jump. But because of this thing, it basically becomes smooth there. So in some sense, I mean, you could say, well, at m times n is the dimension of the whole thing. So if you keep m times n fixed, you see, if you differentiate this, you'll get a 1 over m here. But then there's two things in derivative. So the first derivative of this vanishes, and the second, I think, also matches for the two sides. Okay, so there's the curve again, and now let's just investigate the magnitudes there. So let's define this little quantity delta, which is this, and now I'm going to use the value of C for the later times. So we have this value, then if you define Y to be this quantity, then then you find that the flux is negative over a time period. Well, in arbitrary dimensions it's this, and in four dimensions it's about 37 times the size of the whole. But that's actually small. I should have probably indicated the average time between the emission of quanta. And that's much, it's by factors that have to do with the inverse of this as to how frequency quanta come out. So, you know, you don't, maybe one quantum comes out every 1,000 or 10,000 times the size of the whole. So this is really a time short compared to the time of individual quanta. So the flux is negative, and it gives a mass. Well, the negative flux would say if you interpret that also as meaning the black hole mass went up, then the mass increase of the black hole would be this, where this is the Hawking temperature at this peak. So it's a really tiny fraction of one thermal quantum. It's less than 0.09%. So that's the Hawking temperature at the time very near there when the von Neumann entropy is maximized and the flux is negative, leading to the increase in mass. So it's a very tiny, it's for a short period. Well, it's of the same order as the time between emission of successive quanta, but it is less. I probably should have calculated that factor, but it's less by a factor of, you know, maybe 100 or so than the time between successive emissions. And the total energy coming out is very tiny. Again, this is, you know, some things that are of order unity in the same sense that this is of order unity. It's not small because of some small coupling constant or anything. It's just pies and solving differential equations.
If you replace photons by scalar fields, does the sign change?
Well, it would be this factor would be bigger. So it might increase the effect by a factor of, I don't know, 5 or 10. I didn't try putting in that. But my first PhD student actually did massless scalars, but then he wrote his thesis, but we never got around to publishing it. So But then, wait a minute, who was it? Somebody else published massless scalars from a black hole. But I didn't compare the numbers here. So here I was just doing it for the known massless particles in nature, photons and gravitons. Now let's talk about this negative flux. See, this was in the Bianchi-Sperling model, you had some definite two-dimensional geometry. So now in quantum mechanics, we'd expect there to be fluctuations in the geometry. So let's consider the uncertainty in the time of this negative flux. If you assume that it's sort of like an ensemble of different space-times, in which this for each space-time, maybe you get some definite von Neumann entropy and some definite peak. But for different members of the ensemble, there'll be different times at which this occurs. So the idea is because of random Rudian fluctuations in the number of particles emitted, and the number of particles basically goes as m squared or r squared, then the square root goes as r over the square root of g, and each particle takes a time roughly of r to be emitted. So the Hawking if you consider the Hawking evaporation to give an ensemble of semi-classical spacetimes, each with its own time at which the von Neumann entropy, the radiation is maximized. So the RMS spread in these times would be of order this times this, or in other words, r squared. And so for a solar mass of about 10 to the 38 Planck units, this would be of the order of 10 to the 76 Planck times, or 10 to the 15 times the present age of the universe. So there's an uncertainty of 10 to the 15 times the present age of the universe when a solar mass black hole would reach the peak of this thing. So if this relation applied to each spacetime in the ensemble, then there would be a negative mass flux of this energy over time for solar mass is less than a millisecond, but it's uncertain by a time of the order 10 to the 38 times the duration of the negative flux, which is a time roughly 15 orders of magnitude larger than the present age of the universe. So it seems to be the effect of this negative energy flux, if it really occurs, seems to be quite negligible and virtually impossible to detect. It would be, surely be washed out by averaging over the uncertain time at which the von Neumann entropy is maximized. So I think if you really did the expectation by the energy, this would just get all washed out, and there'd never be a time in which the expectation value is negative. Now, there would be just even any thermal emission, if you actually measured the energy for a short period of time, there's some probability that would be negative. So you could find quantum fluctuations. Of course, that's not the expectation value. That would be a specific realization. You look at a particular time and a particular realization, you could find negative flux, and you might say that might also tend to sort of wash it out. But if you did, I guess I'm saying that if you did an utterly huge number of experiments with a large number of black holes, then my guess is that this negative flux, it may occur in a specific realization, but that the time of that is going to be washed out by the being uncertain by the quantum uncertainty. So when you did the quantum average over a huge number of things, you would never find a period where there's negative energy flux. Yes. Right.
Then, if that's the case, if this is correct, why don't we get hit by black holes that are evaporating all the time? If there is a good likelihood that they could be moving around so far from wherever they started.
Well, they're so far when the black holes are big. So the uncertainty position is also of order this. So, 10 to the 15 times the present size of the universe for a solar mass one. Pardon? But let's see. So, but I mean, if you want one to do a significant fraction of the evaporation, then it has at the beginning of the universe, it would have to have a mass of about 10 to the 15 grams or so. So say about 10 to let's say 10 to the 20 Planck units. So the square of that is 10 to the 40 Planck units. And so that, let's see, so Planck length is about 10 to the minus 35 centimeters. So of order 10 to the 5, so of order 100 kilometers. I guess a primordial, okay, this is off the top of my head, but I'm saying that a primordial black hole that would have significantly evaporated by today, then would have, the uncertainty of the position today would be of the order of 100 kilometers. Right, right.
We don't know where to start in the early universe. So it's starting some random position, it's starting some random position. And so I don't think there's any testable
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's going to affect the problem because we don't know where they started. So, I mean, I don't think that's a problem we're going to be hit. It's presumably just inflation, presumably diluted out most of the little primordial black holes. I mean, you know, I'd be highly surprised if we actually detect one. I mean, it'd be nice. I mean, Stephen Hawking and I did write a paper about primordial black holes, detecting them. But I mean, I don't give out any hope that we're actually going to see them because I suspect that, you know, inflation smoothed out the conditions that the probability of their of producing one big enough to last. Yeah. I guess that's. I guess I would say that. So okay, now okay. This is kind of a minor problem, but just I mentioned that if you took this von Neumann entropy to be close to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in the latter stages, to have this stage, you find that this becomes negative for when this is small. I guess I didn't write the actual formulas, but anyway, it turns out the second derivative if you plug this in and take the first and second derivative, the second derivative dominates over the square of the first derivative because they're both. You know, this is going to zero. You know, it bends down and does like that. So in this case, okay, this is an ad hoc thing. But suppose we don't know what the actual number of states are relative to size when it's really tiny. So let's suppose that the von Neumann entropy, if x is r squared over that, or in other words, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy divided by this 8 pi a, just to make it simple. So in other words, it has this relationship. So when the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is large, this dominates over this, and this S is just given by the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. But when the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy gets small, let's suppose that this goes as basically the square of it. Then you find that the flux has this expected form, and then it just has a correction factor that's always within a factor of 3 of unity. So this flux, if I put this into the thing, this never goes negative, and in fact it increases because this factor r is going down. This factor increases. It increases monotonically with time, and always remains with a factor of 2 of this expression. So there's no problem constructing an S that's close to the Bekenstein-Hawking black hole entropy for a large black hole, but deviates when the hole gets small. So when the hole gets small, and this term dominates, it deviates. It goes like the square of the Bekenstein-Hawking one. And then you could have this Bianchi Smirlik flux stay positive. So just to plot this factor F ahead here, you can see here's the final time. I just constructed it so it actually agreed at the very end, but it dips down again by a factor of roughly 3 before that. That's an ad hoc thing, but I'm just saying there's not any serious problem of getting rid of the problem there. Okay, so in conclusion, this Bianchi-Smirlik formula, which was derived for a two-dimensional model black hole with quantum field theory and indefinite space dimetric, say with boundaries given by a moving mirror, seems to work fairly well for quantum holes in higher dimensions, but there are some inadequacies in the model. Perhaps the most serious is the fact that you can't match the entropy and energy flux both before and after the peak of the von Neumann entropy with a fixed value of this constant C. If the black hole evaporation process is not adiabatic, but generates extra entropy in the radiation in excess of the decrease in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. In other words, gray body factors mean that you can't match before and after the peak with the same value of C. And then the second conclusion was this potential problem with the negative flux predicted by the peak value of the von Neumann entropy, which would cause the black hole briefly to gain mass instead of losing it monotonically. But the numerical results show it's a very tiny increase of the mass, less than 0.09% of the energy of a single quantum of the energy of the Hawking temperature of the black hole at that time. And you can further argue that this tiny effect would be totally swamped by the quantum uncertainty of when in each semi-classical space-time the von Neumann entropy would reach its peak. And then third and most minor is that the extrapolating the expected behavior of the von Neumann entropy, saying that S dot goes as some constant over R, to the final stages leads to negative flux, but unlike the negative flux near the peak, which you can't be avoided, I mean, that formula, because the S dot squared goes to zero at the peak and the S double dot has negative, you can't avoid a negative from that formula, but you can avoid it at late times You can modify the assumed behavior of the von Neumann entropy during the final evaporation, so the Bianchi-Smirlik formula continues to give a positive and even monotonically rising flux at the end of the evaporation. So with that, I'll conclude my things, and it's a very beautiful formula, and I'm delighted to be here with to discuss the thing. And you know, there's some potential issues of how, you know, if you apply it to higher dimensions, and how, you know, how do you deal with these potential issues? So thanks.
Thank you very much. I guess I have a comment. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's just to understand that. So the point, the whole picture, don't you get a choice of what you want to count? So let's say your picture is, I start off with the universe, let's say, which is in a pure state, and there's no black hole, and then I form a black hole. I know if I believe in unitarity, then I know my state is pure, presumably, and there's some detail there, there's a lot of compute things in detail. Now, in this picture, so you're saying, well, now I have a Hawking-Bekenstein formula that tells me what the entropy of this thing is. I don't have a macroscopic description, let's say I don't, but there's some formula I plug in it, okay, I get A over 4, that's the,
right.
Usually the number of states that I that whatever the theory maps onto is there. Okay, now you say, okay, I have a formula that counts entropy, and then I go and count how many photons I receive at 5+, and that's another measure of entropy of the stuff that comes out, right? So you've got two
right.
entropies that you're comparing, and those two actually are different. So the rate of change of the black hole is actually less than the entropy of the photons that you receive on the outside.
Right.
Don't you already have an internal inconsistency in the counting of whatever you think is making up the system?
No, usually.
Well, I'm just saying at that stage, that's okay. So in the early stages, of course, the von Neumann entropy is much less than the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So there's no so.
But the total is less, but the rate of change is higher.
Well, but that's it's you're comparing the rate of change of the von Neumann entropy of the radiation with the change in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black. But the change in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is not the same as the change in the von Neumann entropy of the black hole. In other words, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is going down, but the von Neumann entropy is going up. Yeah, but I mean, I mean, there's no obvious reason why the von Neumann entropy, why it should go up at the negative of the rate for what the other one going down. I mean. Well, I guess okay. So maybe what? Let's see. So is what you're saying that okay? If you let the black hole totally evaporate and you calculate the what I call the thermodynamic entropy of the radiation, which is doing the coarse graining of just calculating the entropy of each mode and adding that up, then in the end that entropy, that coarse grained entropy, is more than the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the initial black hole. But the idea would be is that there's actually entanglement between these modes of the radiation. So the actual von Neumann entropy at the end would be zero. It's a pure state.
But how do you know that's not happening immediately at the beginning already?
What's not happening at the immediate?
Well, you're already saying that the stuff coming out is not as thermal as it looks. That's what the whole premise is, right?
Well, we don't know for sure when this entanglement starts, but I guess I'm saying if it acts like a typical system, if it acts like a typical system when you divide it up into these two subsystems, then there's very little entanglement before you get to the peak, before the thermodynamic entropy of the radiation reaches the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So I'm just saying that therefore it's natural. I mean, I can't prove that there aren't really more correlations early on than this gives, but I'm just saying if this acts as a typical system, then if there really aren't more in correlations in the radiation than this formula would give, then I'm saying there's very little correlations in the radiation before this time. And it's not suddenly that afterward, now there start to be correlations between two body things. It's really entanglement with the whole thing. So you'd have to know the whole. It's not that after this, now you can suddenly just look at a small number of modes and see they're entangled. No, I believe that no matter which modes, whether it's early modes or late modes, if you look at, roughly speaking, if you look at less than half of them, you're going to see negligible entanglement. But if you look at all the modes up to some time, once you've got more than half, roughly speaking, then you've got this. So I guess I don't see any obvious.
Well, but a way out of your C changing value is to just say that it's increased at a different rate initially, and then you don't have a problem with. I mean, your conclusion
well,
is constant would have to change. It's kind of strange.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that if I understand this constant, which is it a formula, this drive for a two-dimensional black hole where, well, basically there aren't any gray body factors and basically you have a fixed geometry. I'm just saying I think this is a place where that we're extrapolating that formula to the four-dimensional case doesn't work. Yeah. But I guess I just mean is you aren't taking into account quantum fluctuations in the geometry. So that's why I sometimes said semi-classical, which I don't know if that's the right word. I really mean a definite, not quantized, you know, background for your formula. So yeah. So I don't think. I mean, you could. Right? I don't know. You could ask. I mean, maybe I should ask Bill if information is lost. I suppose would you think that then, I guess, the final von Neumann entropy, I suppose it would be a factor of B bigger than the initial black hole entropy? Would you think that's true or what?
I don't know what B is, so I missed
it. No, B was a factor by which the radiation entropy was bigger than the decrease in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy.
1.48.
Yeah, this 1.48 factor. So, I mean, in other words, would you...
It's that factor is infinity. So the total radiation entropy a long time after the black hole has evaporated is a huge amount bigger than the entropy, the loss of Bekenstein-Hawking, because it's got such a huge space in which it can bounce around in.
Right. But the bouncing around, I mean, I would think that even you might believe that's a unitary process, right? With that, the bouncing around, I mean, let's assume it's...
If you put radiation in a box, are you saying the entropy is going up?
It interacts with itself,
but if you do the von Neumann, suppose you did the von Neumann entropy. Suppose you have a perfectly reflecting box and you don't have other degrees of freedom. Then I would have thought that even if you say that black holes increase the von Neumann entropy, that once after it's emitted, as long as you don't consider it going back into the black hole again, you don't get more von Neumann entropy from the bouncing around because that's just the unitary, wouldn't it?
That's a whole other level of radical idea beyond even information loss.
No, it's just a different way of defining entropy.
I mean, I agree with you what you say for the coarse-grained entropy,
so
but
the entropy of the radiation is supposed to be less than the entropy of...
No, I'm just saying it's more. You had a black hole...
B is... I didn't hear that part of the talk.
So. Okay, B is the factor by which... The thermodynamic entropy of the radiation is greater than the decrease in the Bekenstein-Hawking thing. So
I might make an argument that it's actually less than rather than greater than, i.e. that B is less than 1 because you're cutting off a thermal spectrum, and a thermal spectrum which looks 0 and then has a bump in it is, of course, a much more special, has much lower entropy than just for the same energy than a thermal spectrum would have. So B should be less than 1. But that's just
okay.
It's a different B that he's talking about. It's the B, it's how much the air, the Bekenstein-Hawking area changes, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy changes. That
sorry?
It's the rate of change of Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So
well, that's not B. B is
so
a.
B is defined with respect to that. I think the way B is thinking about B is the ratio of the thermal.
I don't know what B is, so I'm trying to clarify this.
So B, I guess, is equal to minus dS radiation. And that was over d Hawking. So that the top was I sometimes call it the thermodynamic entropy. It's the coarse-grained entropy of the radiation where you take the entropy, the von Neumann entropy of each mode and add it up, ignoring any entanglement between different modes. This one is just a quarter A. So I'm just saying that the emission process increases coarse-grained entropy. And so maybe I don't know that one should be surprised. If you really think that black holes really lose information, and so when you form a black hole.
No, I understand. We're just, okay.
So I guess if you form a black hole, maybe if information is lost, once the black hole forms, would you say that the von Neumann entropy of the black hole is just right, more or less immediately a one quarter A, or?
I would. Ascribe of a Neumann entropy to the black hole.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's the whole information loss thing. I mean, I don't believe that there are a bunch of these microstates that you can add up and figure out what the entropy is.
Yeah. So probably it wouldn't be surprising if you said that, well, if you let the black hole evaporate, then the von Neumann entropy of, if information is lost, the von Neumann entropy of the radiation could be bigger than the initial Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. I mean, presumably there would be nothing particularly surprising about that.
I mean, as you said, it's the radiation of the radiation is a coarse-grained entropy, so yes, it would be bigger.
Yeah.
Recently,
yes.
The previous discussion on entropy, in fact, it was economics and entropy, and we discussed there was a theory from sociometrics, the 90s. Could you combine it with the entropy of a cell? Could that be like a toy model? I'm just wondering, if you change scales, the cell as a universe, there's something, again, you'd have to fudge it, but the proteasomes in the cell, there's 8 times 10 to the 5 in an average cell. So you'd have to say there's 100 billion galaxies in the universe. With the entropy of a proteasome, and sort of as the mural there on the blackboard, have any relation to the entropy of the black hole that you're talking about?